So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink podcast with me, your host, Anna Donaghy. If you've noticed that the drinking culture in the UK is changing and you're curious about why and what this means to your world, then this is the podcast for you. Throughout this series, I will be chatting with the thought-provoking, forward-thinking people at the heart of this shift to find out what makes them tick and to explore the sober curious perspective from all angles. And I'll also be giving you oodles of personal tools and tactics to help you get on board the Big Drink Rethink. So hello and welcome back to today's show, where my guest is Jessica Leahy, teacher, writer, speaker, and author of The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. It's an absolutely brilliant book, a hopeful, empowering guide for parents, caregivers, and educators who want to understand the real risks around substance use and what we can actually do every day to build resilience in the next generation. Jessica has a wealth of experience as an educator, certainly working with adolescents and families, but also she brings a powerful personal perspective from her own journey of recovery. So I am so excited to have Jessica on today to talk about, oh gosh, a heap of things: parenting, breaking unhealthy cycles, and I think at the heart of it, just the power of open, honest conversations to bring around generational change. So welcome, welcome, Jessica. It's a real thrill to have you here.
What an intro. Thank you so, so much. Like when I first got the idea for this book, it was literally the book I really wanted and needed and couldn't find. So thank you so much.
Oh, no. I've read it. I've listened to it twice. I've recommended it. We're going to talk about it now. I'm a big fan. So I'm very glad you did come to write it. Now, let's talk about you very quickly, first of all. Is there anything you want to add to that introduction about yourself? Maybe, because I said you teach, maybe tell us who you teach, where you teach, what you teach, and how you came to write the book.
So I taught for a very long time, and I've taught every grade from sixth grade, so middle school in the U.S., all the way through to 12th grade. And middle school really was my favorite place to teach. Those sort of like, you know, 12 to, well, like 11 to like 13 year olds, 14. I love them so much. And that's where my first book, which actually dovetails with The Addiction Inoculation, it was called The Gift of Failure. That's where that book was born. But the thing that was really fun about my teaching is in the last 5 years, I needed to teach part-time, not full-time, because I was doing so much speaking and I was on the road so much. So I taught part-time at a drug and alcohol rehab for adolescents. And that, to me, was the best teaching job I've ever had. Respect in case any of my students from other places are listening. but teaching there really stripped teaching back to its bare essence, which was gain trust and get them engaged. And these are kids who often had very little hope, very low levels of self-efficacy. And so even just to get them to trust me, since so many other adults had let them down, I would do that job over again. If they were still open to adolescents, I would still be driving all the way across the state to teach them. I love them so much.
That's absolutely brilliant. So I'm going to set the scene for your book straight away, because there's so much within it that I want to talk about, obviously. So many listeners of this podcast are in that questioning space, kind of. Well, first of all, it's called The Big Drink Rethink. So it's, we're prompting that questioning. We're prompting that.
I love that position. I love that question. I love the fact that we're allowed to pose that question, even if we're not like full on, full blown, you know, alcoholics, which is what I consider myself to be. I love that we can have that questioning moment now. And the science is changing too. We're learning so much more about what alcohol does to the body, especially now. You know, remember, it's only been in the last generation that we've been able to look inside the human brain as it's working and to see what part of the brain's activated and what we can lose when we start using during adolescence. And I think that is going to radically change the way we think about alcohol in particular, but drugs and alcohol generally over the next generation or so.
I do get a lot of questions from readers or listeners rather, and they wonder about their own drinking. Of course, they're thinking about their own drinking. They're thinking about what it's going to mean to their kids. And this is obviously at the heart of what your book is about. Because your book to me, Jess, felt like both a wake up call and also a relief. You know, it's a very empowering book. It doesn't preach. It really does empower. And it left me thinking, you know, why aren't we talking more about the science and about the stats and about the dynamics of sort of generational drinking, the cycle? So
because it's scary for, I mean, that's what I hear. I mean, so Gift of Failure, my first book, was like this New York Times bestseller. It's easy to get people to show up for those talks because it's about learning and engagement and all that stuff. But the minute you say to someone, come and hear this expert on substance use prevention, it's really hard to get butts in seats because, you know, I wouldn't have gone when I was still drinking actively as an alcoholic if I was thinking about whether or not I have an issue. Plus, there are parents who don't show up because they don't want to go, for example, to their kid's school and have someone think, oh, they're worried about their, you know, it's such a loaded topic. And so that's where I get this incredible drive and what I feel like is an obligation to talk about it as much as possible. Also, because I wasn't allowed to talk about it as a kid, which I now understand to be part of why I feel so driven to talk about it now. But it scares people. And in the same way that the sex talk scares people, in the same way that the porn talk scares people. But the more we talk about it, the less loaded that topic becomes. Like talking about drugs and alcohol with my kids is just a normal thing that we do. Mm. It's not loaded at all. It's just a conversation that we have. So the more you talk about it, the easier it gets.
I mean, ultimately, the conversation so often starts way too late. I think this is the point.
Oh, right.
You make mm-hmm. so clearly in your book, it's way, way, way too late. And often at a point when, you know, there's crisis, but of course, the addiction inoculation, as the name infers, sort of flips that, and it talks about what we can be doing earlier before a problem even takes hold. And it's a real kind of rallying cry for awareness and education and honest, courageous conversations.
Well, and the conversations don't start. I mean, the most effective substance use prevention that we know of starts at pre-K and kindergarten. And we're not talking about weed or crystal methamphetamine. We're talking about things like, you know, if you see, sweetie, if you see something on the floor that looks like candy, make sure you talk to a grown-up before you put that in your mouth, because it's dangerous to put things in our body and we're not sure what they are. And a lot of medicines look like candy. And they do that on purpose to make it more, you know, easier for us to swallow. Or conversations about, you know, the reason my name is on this pill bottle that I got from the pharmacy is because it's only for me. You never take a medication that doesn't have your name on the label. Those conversations are just about bodily autonomy and about safety. Mm. And those conversations very naturally lead to other conversations. And the one thing I learned from The Gift of Failure is that people, and I did not understand this at first, how much people want scripts for conversations that are difficult for them. So the addiction inoculation has as many scripts as possible, because like I said, I didn't fully understand the extent to which people were like, no, but tell me exactly what to say at this stage, at this age, at this age, at this age. So I was happy to provide that.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. With regards to the title, can I just ask you mm-hmm. one thing, which the addiction inoculation obviously speaks towards a sort of a preventative intervention sort of approach to substance. What do you actually mean by the culture of dependence rather? Is this a statistical overview of the scale of a problem out there, or?
No, actually. So for me, it had more to do with, and, you know, I don't know if you know anything about publishing, but there were probably, easily 50 different subtitles. So in nonfiction, you have a title, and that title we talked about a lot, actually, about what exactly I meant by inoculation. And then it came out during COVID and it got this whole other loaded thing to it anyway. But subtitles, have to do a lot of heavy lifting for the title so that people will understand what book it is they're picking up. And by culture of dependence, I think I meant broadly that we live in an era when if you don't want to feel something, or you don't want to cope with something, or something hurts, or something just feels bad, we tend to push it away or numb it. And I think that it's that messaging to our kids that leads to this dependent situation, because when you use something else in order to numb your feelings rather than developing coping mechanisms, what you're doing is not just creating dependence in the sense of, you know, like a scientific, you know, addiction, like if I don't take this drug, I'm going to feel bad in my body, but also, I've been talking about this with a friend of mine whose kid went to rehab recently, that when you don't have coping mechanisms that you have learned, that you then become dependent on whether it's messed up behavior, or whether it's weird coping mechanisms, or whether it's substances to manage your coping. So it's not just about like addiction in the body, or substance use dependence, actually, is the way we're supposed to talk about this, substance dependence, but also just a dependence on something other than healthy coping mechanisms to manage our stress and pain. And when you talk to kids, in fact, the most recent survey of kids about why they use, you know, if you ask adults why kids start to use drugs and alcohol, a lot of adults will say, because I ask them this all the time, will say peer pressure, because we always want to think, no, my kid would never. It must be some bad kid over there. But that is not why kids say they use. Kids say they use to manage anxiety and stress. And so it's this cycle of we use to manage anxiety and stress, and so we bypass the need to come up with coping mechanisms for our anxiety and stress. And that's really and it's not that I thought people were going to be going there in their heads when they read this subtitle, but that's where I was in my head when I wrote that subtitle.
Yeah, nothing. Well, thank you for clearing that up, because I sort of went to a slightly different place as well, which I think is, you know, another perfectly relevant place, which is this idea of, you know, quick fix society, you know, instant gratification.
It's all those things. Yeah. Yep. You know, it's you take your kid to the dentist and they automatically prescribe, you know, an opiate and for pain relief. And, you know, that's not necessary. And so it's all of these things. And the reason I'm hesitant to say that when you asked if it was a societal sort of dependence addiction thing, the reason I'm hesitant to go there is that in adolescence, we've seen an overall downward trend in use among adolescents. And I want to celebrate that as much as possible. So I don't want to paint this doom and gloom scenario saying that it's increasing, that kids are turning to drugs and alcohol, because it's not. I think prevention has changed in response to some of the things we talked about, the brain scans and then understanding what works and the third party objective analysis of whether or not a substance use prevention program works, rather than just say no or, you know, scared straight. That stuff does not work. But, you know, those are the programs I went through in high school. Mm. Not only do they not work, they can raise the risk of kids using drugs and alcohol. So that I want to give kids and prevention its due, which is to say that, yeah, we've been headed in a really good direction, slowly, but surely, and over the past decade or so.
So the fact that prevention is helping us move in the right direction, I suppose there's a sort of, at the root of a lot of quiet worry for parents when it comes to addiction, of how much of this is nature versus nurture, how much can addiction be prevented, how useful are preventative actions. And of course your book covers this, and I'm going to keep saying this throughout this episode. I really want people to read your book, but genetics obviously come up.
Yep, because that was the first place my brain went, because that's my situation.
And I mean in the coaching realm, I often, when I'm talking to clients, it transpires, as you would imagine, very frequently that they are children of alcoholics, or at least they have had an upbringing in a family that has potentially had an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. So just briefly, because I know it's a massive topic, Jess, but what do we know now about this science, and where does that leave us as parents? Because I think we do worry, if addiction runs in the family, are we fighting a losing battle? Your work would suggest not.
That was where my brain went. Okay, so I finally, on June 7th, 2013, when my dad did a little intervention on me. And by the way, I think that prevention isn't just about prevention. I can't guarantee that my kids are never going to go down this road. But what I do know is that for me anyway, I think of getting to recovery as like a 100-piece puzzle. The more pieces that are in that puzzle, the more, if you do have an issue with drugs or alcohol, then the closer you are to realizing that you need help. And I started, you know, when I started thinking about prevention myself, I saw it as both giving my kids the ammunition, the information they need in order to think in a really reasoned way about whether or not they want to drink or whether or not they want to use. But also, given that my kids are at higher risk, which I'll discuss in just a second, they are going to need as much ammunition as possible also to realize, oh, this isn't social for me anymore. This is a serious problem. Mm-hmm. So hopefully they'll start with more pieces in their puzzle if they do go down that road. This is a really hard thing to break apart because there's so many statistical confounders when we talk about nature versus nurture, genetics versus the other stuff. But genetics appears to be about 50 to 60% of the risk picture. That comes from Dr. Mark Schuchat at University of California, San Diego. So that does not mean that, like, just remember, so if you take risk and you make a pie, it's about half or a little bit more than half of that picture. And the rest is adverse childhood experiences or, you know, big T trauma, things that cause toxic stress over long periods of time. The CDC's list of adverse childhood experiences include things like neglect and violence in the home and substance use disorder in the home and that kind of thing. An incarcerated parent, divorce and separation is on that list. And then there are a few other things that kind of fill in the gaps in there. But if we think about genetics, is that mainly about half of it? And then, and just realize that, you know, if you have a first or second degree relative with substance use disorder, you and your kids are at elevated risk. And so I don't mean that to scare anyone, but I do want people to say, oh, that means we really have to talk about this stuff, which is, for me, I want that to be a piece of information my kids have in the same sense that they know that they're at higher risk of high cholesterol or stroke or diabetes or whatever the rest of their medical risk picture looks like. It's a piece of information they need in order to make smart decisions.
I think that's a brilliant way of describing it and actually citing it within the other, you know, the context of other things that you'd jolly well make sure your kids were aware of if they were at risk of something.
Well, and people say all the time, and this is wrong, that, oh, teenagers don't understand the consequences of their actions. And that is not true. And by the way, if you want to love your teenager more and understand your teenager more and empathize with your teenager or a teenager you know more, just learn a little bit about the adolescent brain. And both of my books include information on that. Maybe it's one of my favorite topics, frankly. It's not that they don't understand the consequences of their action. It's that they weigh them differently. They weigh the possible positive benefits heavier than the possible negative outcomes. And so I want to make sure that that possible negative outcome side has as much weight as possible on it. And their risk for substance use disorder really needs to be one of those fingers on the scale of the negative side.
That makes a huge amount of sense. But when we're talking about genetic risk, we're not talking about in an alcohol gene.
No, I wish we were. Wouldn't that be great? Because there's this thing called CRISPR technology that means that we can like just flick certain genes out. It's a miracle piece of technology. But that's not how the genetics for substance use disorder work. There's a wonderful book by Danielle Dick, D-I-C-K, and it's called The Child Code. The Child Code, she's a geneticist and an expert in alcohol use disorder. And that book talks about genetics and personality and substance use, predilection for substance use disorders in there as well. It would be so great if it was just a single gene, but it's not. It's tied in with personality and it's tied in with body and brain chemistry and all these different things that we can't just point to one gene and say, ah, there it is. Bye-bye. Get rid of it. That would be so great. For example, there's a disease called SMA or spinal muscular atrophy. And there is a single gene that we have a very expensive medication for. And if you give it to a baby with this thing, it's just done. They are not going to get that disease. And that would be great. I would love that. Yeah.
Wouldn't it just?
Yeah.
So when I do talk, because my knowledge of this is lagging way behind yours, but I've definitely, when I've talked to clients before and they say, well, I've, you know, I've got alcohol in my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, this is why I am where I am. I suppose one thing that I've always said to them as well, I don't believe that there is one individual gene. And part of my eagerness, I suppose, to counter that sense of this is my destiny,
right,
is because clearly you want people to feel empowered. That if 50% of the pie or 60% of the pie is genetic, then it still means that a good 40 or 50% of the pie isn't.
Yeah. And teasing that apart, I think free will, so this comes, this is, you have gotten essentially at the crux of a lot of debate about different kinds of recovery and why people think they're, some people, you know, for example, 12-step programs, some people are like, okay, they don't want to say I'm an alcoholic because that takes all the power away, blah, 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 blah. I do happen to refer to myself as an alcoholic because I think it's important for me to remember that that's a very important thing that I have to keep an eye on. What I know is my brain reacts differently than my sister's brain when it comes to alcohol. It just does. There's a click. It just does something different to me. But here's where my power comes in around that. Once I take that first drink, I really am powerless against alcohol. I can't stop once I've had the first drink, but I can choose about that first drink. I can choose whether or not I'm going to have that first drink. And I know I can come up with coping mechanisms. I can come up with strategies. I can use the people who love me and support me around me to help me with that. But I do think it's important to understand that if you're talking to someone who is actively using and actively spiraling, and they are to a certain extent not decision making, like the substance is making the decisions for mm-hmm. them, or the addiction, whether it depends on how you want to talk about it. But I completely understand the resistance to powerlessness. And ironically, or coincidentally, that's a big part of what self-efficacy is all about. You know, when it came time to excerpt the book, The Addiction Inoculation, in the media, I knew that I wanted the New York Times piece, probably the piece that was going to get the most attention, to be the chapter about self-efficacy. Because and it's why that's what I focus on when I speak in a lot in schools, and I talk to the kids during the day, to sort of teachers in the afternoon, and parents in the evening about learning and substance use prevention stuff. And the biggest point I want to make is the more we empower kids to feel like that when they make decisions or when they take action, that they can affect positive change, that that's one of the biggest prevention things we can give them, even though it doesn't seem like substance use prevention on its face. It's incredibly important for kids to understand that they can make change in their life. And one of the things that's fairly typical about kids in recovery, from my perspective, is very low levels of self-efficacy, whether that's because they're completely out of control, you know, whether it's because they're in foster care group homes or in the state's custody and they don't have any choice whatsoever about what happens to them next, or because they're being very, very overparented and their parents are just being very, what I call directive parents, that they're choosing everything for them. And the kid is like, well, why would I bother taking action? I don't get to choose anything in my life. All of those kids can develop what's called really low levels of self-efficacy. And that's a big, big risk factor for substance use disorder.
And the other thing that you mentioned in your book, which I think is tied into that, is when we just choose not to talk about alcohol at all.
Right. Right.
Children, teenagers, adolescents, in each of those situations that you just talked mm-hmm. about, I can understand how they can, you know, quite quickly lose agency or the sense of self-efficacy. But also, I was really, to be honest, the reason I'm coming in on it is because it wasn't something I'd really considered before. But if in a family where there is perhaps a history, or not even necessarily a history, where there is a parent who drinks, has a drinking problem, a drinking issue, and it's just not spoken about.
Right.
We just don't talk about it. Or we talk about it in almost trivializing terms. You know, and I can relate this to my husband's got a large Irish family. And there's always an alcoholic. Once you've had 12 or 13 kids, there's always going to be an alcoholic, a nun, a priest, you know. And, right. And you know, Uncle so-and-so, oh, yeah, he likes his drink.
Well, it's not just trivializing either. It's, you know, one of the most common questions I get from parents is, okay, great. Does this mean that prevention means, you know, effective prevention means I can't drink in front of my kids? And I say, yes. Absolutely not. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if you're going to drink in front of your kids, then you need to be thinking a lot about the messages you're sending through your actions. So in the absence of words around alcohol, drugs, our habits, whatever, there's a vacuum that's going to be filled by our actions and translating our actions, right? So if your actions are, oh man, I had the worst day at work. I just need a drink. Or, you know, I was reading a book the other day and they were talking about how in the American show Bewitched, Darren used to come home from work and she would say, would you like a martini, sweetie? And he would say, oh yeah, it was a tough day. Make it a double. Or, you know, we're going to Thanksgiving at grandma's house and there better be wine there today because this is going to be a long day. All of that, what we're saying is, ooh, I'm having bad feelings. I'm going to drink at it. So if that's the messaging you're sending kids, then what you're saying is my coping mechanism is not internal. It's coming from over there. And again, you're talking about powerlessness. You've talked about, you know, lack of this self-efficacy thing that I was talking about or lack of a locus of control. What we're doing is translating that on over to our kids. And yet one of the most powerful preventative things we can do is give power back, give control and a locus of control back to kids. So if we're not talking about it, someone's talking about it and it's advertising, the media, you know, yep. Alcohol companies, it's worth a lot of money to them to get our brand loyalty early. It's especially worth it to them within the context of certain sports to establish that brand loyalty very early. And they're talking and we're talking through our actions. And so, you know, what's there to counter that if not our conversations about, you know, what it's really doing to our brain and bodies and why it's more dangerous during adolescence than during adulthood. And again, I forgot to say this in the beginning. I'm not talking about whether or not you drink as an adult. You are an adult. You do whatever the heck you want. But as an expert in adolescence, adolescent development, and adolescence and alcohol and substance use prevention, drinking or using drugs and alcohol during adolescence is just different than it is during adulthood. The brain is in this period of incredible development that if we mess with it from a neurotransmitter standpoint, from a whatever chemical standpoint, we are messing with brain development. And I just want, there are a couple things I want for kids, and it's to get to their adulthood with their brain intact and with the most potential it can have, and for kids to feel loved, heard, seen, known, supported for who they are. And that feeling like they deserve to take up space in the world. And those two things, preserving their brains, getting it to adulthood, and feeling like they're worthy of love is, you know, at the heart of the substance use prevention question too.
I'm so pleased you pointed out the higher risk, you know, the issues related to adolescent or sort of teenage. Well, it's up until about the age of 25, isn't it? 20 to 25,
it's the early to mid-20s. We say early to mid-20s. My kids are now 26 and 21, and they're adults. They can do what they want, but we're still having a lot of conversations, even with the 26-year-old. I'm talking with the 26-year-old about drinking and substance use quite a bit, actually, because it comes up in our, I mean, it's what I do for a living, but still, we talk about it a fair amount. So, yeah.
And in this family, in my family, we have these conversations and it's so easy to get into conversations around hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just I'll paint a picture. Obviously, I don't drink anymore. I have a 17-year-old daughter who is curious. She knows what I do. She respects what I do. She's very proud of what I do, but she still wants to sort of try things for herself. Mm-hmm. I will not purchase it for her. I will not put it into her hands. I know she goes off to parties and she's tried stuff. Even my own husband and I have had conversations whereby he says it's kind of hypocritical though, isn't it, Anna, because you did all those things when you were younger.
I love this question.
And I say, yes, my friend, but I did not know what I know now. So would I have done differently? Possibly. Am I being a hypocrite by sharing new knowledge? I don't think so. What kind of a mother would withhold that kind of knowledge and let her child blindly go on? Now, I'm not preaching for sure, but I want to share in the right ways at the right times. And I hear questions all the time, Jess, from parents who say, my past behavior discredits me.
On the flip side, I've also heard, well, if I've never used drugs or alcohol, then I can't speak from any level of expertise. So that discredits me. So we're in a lose-lose situation.
Yeah.
I will tell you that we have conversations all the time. So my kids obviously know about my substance use abuse. Actually, we shouldn't say that. We're supposed to say substance use disorder. Abuse puts shame and all guilt and all that stuff on the person. But they also know, for example, that my husband has, and this is an authorized topic. I'm allowed to talk about this stuff. My husband calls what we referred to had what we refer to as your father's lost year, where he was really rudderless and used a lot of weed, and the lot of weed participated in the rudderlessness, and the rudderlessness participated in the weed use and the proximity to, he had housemates who grew in the basement and all that other stuff. He also, however, talks about the fact that the reason he was using so much was that he felt hopeless and he did not feel like he was doing what he was supposed to be doing with his life. So when he figured out what he wanted to do with his life and got his purpose back, he talks about the fact that he could feel that he had taken a hit to his short-term memory, which he probably had. He was still in that below 25 place. Mm-hmm. We know that weed, in particular, the little parts of our brain, the receptors that link, that the THC and all the other chemicals and we link onto are right there near the hippocampus and affect our short-term memory and our memory consolidation and processing and all that sort of stuff. So he talks about why he used. He talks about they know that he used. But the context of why he used and the context of here's the hit I think my brain took because of it is incredibly important information. Like that's, there's someone I quote in the book, and don't use his name because it's someone who should have known better and he feels bad about that, that he romanticized it to his kids as like this. He wanted his kids to see him as cool. And he's like, and here's all the stuff I did during college. And his son came back and he said, you know, I kind of think you romanticized that. And I wanted to try all that stuff. So if you can walk that line between, no, I've never, versus, you know, romanticizing it, I think any of those middle places where you're giving information about, you know, the whys and the wherefores, because for a lot of us, it was about managing why we didn't feel like we were enough. If it's problematic use, that tends to be more the scenario. So I think it's important stuff.
It's hugely important. And in this household, as far as I'm concerned, and I can only really speak, you know, from my own position, I am very, very keen to never come from a place of authority about stuff or perfection. I try and come from a place of humility and talk, you know, I don't have all the answers, but there's definitely certain things I wish I had understood when I was younger.
Can I interject, though? There is a place for authority, I think, if you have better evidence than they do. My whole take around the addiction inoculation is I did the best I could with the information I had. And some of that was magical thinking and mythology, like the whole letting my kid have sips will turn them into those moderate European drinkers. It turns like that's not true. But I did the best I could with that information. And then I spent years researching this book and I learned better information. And this is all gift of failure stuff, which is I did the best I could with the information I had. Now I have better information. And so I say a mea culpa. I say it. I apologize for any mistakes I made, but now we're moving forward with this better information. And when it comes to authority about the evidence, I do have that. If it, you know, especially
enough.
Over someone who's engaging in that magical thinking of no, but I think it worked for me, therefore it'll work for my kids. That's not evidence, that's anecdote. And so when I'm out talking to parents or if I'm talking to my kids or whatever, that is a place of, but I do have this up-to-date information that is accurate. So therefore, this is actually, it is authoritative, but I understand what you're saying. What you're saying is not coming at things from a place of, I know everything, you know nothing. Therefore, I'm just going to say what you have to participate in this conversation is just not worth anything because that doesn't work, period.
No. Well, I guess that falls firmly into the camp of not giving a teenager any sense of self-efficacy or just directive.
Yeah. Also, we know lecturing from a learning perspective and a parenting perspective, lecturing doesn't work. It just doesn't. It's the immediately, whether it's from, you know, what we know about how it works in the brain with learning And how we know it works, especially for teenagers, when you start to lecture, they just tune us out and we turn into those peanuts, wah, 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 parents, and they're not listening anymore.
So what are the biggest things parents can influence? What are the biggest things we can influence, even when genetic risk is present? And maybe because genetic risk is present, we have to make sure we can influence where possible. I know this is a very broad question, so I'm sorry if it's too broad.
But it's a great question. Like I said, I can't guarantee, especially given my kids are at elevated risk, and I have nieces too. My sister has two kids, and I am Auntie Alcoholic Jess, who has this. So like my sister... What we know about kids is what we know about child development and what we know about how people turn out in the end is that if they have one adult that they can confide in or that they feel supported by, that they are likely to do much better, even if they've had incredible trauma. There's a book by Michelle Borba called Thrivers that I'm a massive fan of. She looked at a lot of kids who have overcome horrible beginnings, and she wanted to know what are the things that actually help them thrive in life. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we know about kids is if they have that one adult, and it could be a teacher, it could be a pastor, it could be a parent, it doesn't have to be any one person. So at least for substance use disorder, I get to be that one person for my nieces. They know they can confide in me, at least I hope they can. So having that one adult, and if that is not you, and if you're one of those talented people who's smart enough to realize, oh, I think I may not be that person, then just making sure they have another person, that's great too. They need to have someone to talk to, and it may not be the same person for all topics, but making sure they have someone to talk to about stuff, that's super important. And as I said before, this is a long-term process. This is not like an immediate, like you can't just have one conversation before they go to college or before they turn 18 or whatever. That's just trying to do a lot of cleanup late in the game. But that said, I want to make it really clear, if you haven't started because you thought you didn't need to start yet and you're behind, that's okay. Any place you start is great. If you start when they're adults, that's great. You know, just start. That's like the really important thing. And I think, and I talk a lot about, you know, ways to start. I talk a lot about prompting conversations and where conversations can be a little less intimidating, and contexts, you know, make sure everyone's rested, no one's hungry, irritable, you know, coming at your kid on your time when you feel like it's the right time for you is not always the right time for them. That's why a lot of arguing about stuff tends to happen in the moment and tends to not be very instructive, mm-hmm. waiting until, you know, the learning moment is right. But just get started and start thinking about long-term progress. Start thinking more in the long-term than the short-term. Start thinking about progress over end product. So when you were talking about your kid and you said that you're pretty sure she's trying stuff out there in the world, a lot of parents will use, there's this purity analogy that came out of, I believe, my husband grew up in Utah, sort of next door to the, you know, the Mormon church, and he was non-Mormon, but a lot of the stuff that comes out of there is this purity, like a lot of the girls that he knew growing up heard, once you've chewed a piece of gum, no one wants it anymore. So like there's this, or if you lose your virginity, that's it. It's over for you, period. Like that's it. That's not how we do substance use prevention. What we do is if a kid screws up and they use, we have a conversation about that. We have a conversation about what's been learned. We have a conversation about why, you know, why you may have felt the need to use. I quote Chris Herron, a person in recovery and educator on this stuff also. He says, we tend to spend a lot of time talking about that last drink because these are our war stories and they're so dramatic, but we need to be thinking more about that first drink. Like, what's the reason a kid picks up that first time? And for a lot of kids, it's because they don't feel like they're enough, or they don't feel like they fit in, or they don't feel like they have the, they're allowed to take up space in the world. And we have to start talking about that as opposed to, oh, well, now you've used and you're just ruined and it's over and blah, 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 blah. This is a learn from the experience sort of conversation. And make sure you have a contract with your kid in some way that says, you know, you can call me and use this code word and I'll come get you, or you can, you know, whatever. And then my favorite part of the book actually is the part that's not even technically mine. It's the 2.5 pages of excuses that teenagers gave me for ways they could get out of using, and or if they didn't want to at a party, like someone approaches you and says, here, have some drugs or alcohol, and you don't want to, they gave me sort of face-saving excuses they could use. Obviously, no is a complete sentence, but besides that, other things they could say as well. So making sure your kid has all of those resources is going to be super important. So start, give them refusal skills, which is where inoculation comes from. It's inoculation theory in social science. Making sure that you're modeling as well as talking, making sure that you're, you know, watching how your actions are being observed by your kids. You know, as much as we'd like to believe that they do what we say, they don't. They do what we do. So we need to be paying attention to that.
I picked up on a saying or a quote a few years ago now, which is that, you know, we're teaching our kids all of the time, and sometimes we use words.
Yeah. You know, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it was funny, you know, if you go online onto something like, you know, you're watching videos online, often you'll see kids mimic adults in ways ways that are a little bit weird, like pretending to pick up a phone and talk on it, or, you know, just the little actions that we do all day long. You can see tiny, tiny little kids. You can watch kids babble, for example, in sign language. You can, you know, things that kids do because they're observing all the time are going to be the things that they're really picking up early on. In the book, I say, I quote a statistic that was really interesting to me anyway, that in homes where alcohol is present, by the age of 4, kids can pick out the difference between alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages. By the age of 4. Wow. So, yeah. So that freaks me out a little. That means we need to be paying attention to that a lot earlier than we thought.
Jess, there's a question sort of half-baked in my head, so I'm sorry if this doesn't sound particularly articulate. But
no, I love these. Give it to me.
It's just coming out. I'll see how this comes. A lot of people haven't questioned their own relationship with alcohol before.
Right.
So, you know, if you've run into problems with alcohol, maybe you've run into severe problems with alcohol.
Or
maybe,
even let's use the word consequences. If you've run into some consequences of your alcohol use, even if they're, you blacked out and you forgot, or you, whatever. Yeah, consequences are a good way to talk about this.
Yeah, cool. So a lot of people are in that space where they're just sort of thinking about engaging, getting curious about their relationship with alcohol for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it's quite intimidating, I would have thought, in some ways, to start thinking, I now have to try and find the words to prompt and influence and show interest in my child's relationship with alcohol. And I'm not even sure about the words to describe mine. Again, that can get you into a place of, oh, this is just too fucking hard, actually.
Kick it
down the road.
That's why I was saying it's harder to get butts and seats around this topic than it is for like learning and engagement.
It's uneasy stuff, isn't it?
Right, right.
Really uneasy stuff.
Yeah.
So, and is this where you're saying just start?
Yeah, and what's really cool about this is you don't have to pathologize it. Like by the time it came time for me to talk to my kids about it, like I'd known for a long time my issues. Also, they knew they had an alcoholic grandparent. Like when Christmas blew up one year, we didn't say it's because your grandparent, whatever, it's because of some made up lie. We said, both my sister and I, to our children, we're doing Christmas differently this year because this grandparent relapsed. And it's really important for us as parents to protect you from some of what we grew up with. And so that's why we're doing Christmas differently this year, because we love you so much. We want to help you understand what's going on. But also, I think there are ways to not pathologize it. If you're not ready to go there yet, I mean, a lot of people that I know that are in recovery started with dry January, sober October. I'm just going to give it a month. I think there's a clip circulating online of Tom Holland. He said it started for him with a month, a 30-day, like, I need to not drink for a month because of one of these socially acceptable ways to do that, sober October, dry January, whatever. And he realized during that period of time that he thought about it all the time, and that it needed to maybe be longer than 30 days. And keeping in mind, 30 days when it comes to our dopamine cycle, 30 days is how long it takes. There's a great book, by the way, called Dopamine Nation by Anna Lemke. Yeah. I love that book. It takes about 30 days for our brains to self-regulate to come back to homeostasis after we've had, we've been using a lot and messing with that cycle. And it's not just dopamine, there are other neurotransmitters involved, but let's simplify. So 30 days is a great place to start in one of those socially acceptable ways, or sign up for a 5K and say, you know what, ahead of this 5K, I think I'm going to really cut back because, you know, health, or I'm going to eat more broccoli and I'm going to cut out alcohol. Or how about this? Alcohol is empty calories and it's a lot of calories. And so a lot of people find that when they stop drinking, they drop a couple of pounds because they're not taking in all those calories, just like if they were to stop drinking Coke or whatever. There are a lot of super socially acceptable and quote unquote, I hate this word, normal reasons to not drink. So use one of those. If it scares you too much to talk about that drinking is a problem for you, then just talk about it as being drinking is a problem for society or the human body or whatever. And so I'm going to see what it's like for a month without it.
And the wonderful thing about that is you're then able to open up conversations about what you are discovering. What you're learning, and maybe, you know,
watch what happens to sleep, watch what happens to mood, watch what happens to clarity. It's awfully lovely, I do have to say.
I could talk to you all day. I have one question for you that I must get in here now, because I know that you're very passionate about the work that can be done, you know, in schools and colleges and stuff. It's clearly not just about, you know, what we do at home.
Right.
To what degree, Jess, would you suggest that we are failing that generation by not having this conversation more? And I'm going to broaden that out. If we don't want to talk about this conversation that we should be having in terms of it being, you know, substance education, how much are we failing them by not talking about a better set of emotional tools and ways to just coping mechanisms that could serve them better? Because like yourself, and you mentioned it a moment ago, you know, I got to a stage where I was in a right up pickle with alcohol because it was my only tool. And my parents could have talked me to the cows came home to a certain degree about alcohol, but unless I had better tools, I would possibly have ended up using it in a way in the end anyway. So how much what can we be doing there, or how much is it a big problem that we're not getting going there in education?
So what we know about the best substance use prevention programs is that they incorporate social emotional learning skills, and social emotional learning skills, I hate to go into politics a teensy bit here, but some people would have you believe that social emotional learning skills are stupid and they are soft, quote unquote, soft skills, or even worse, that they are where we teach kids about all kinds of liberal leanings that, you know, this country is having a debate right now over social emotional learning. Social emotional learning are pro-social behaviors, the ways that we can interact with other human beings in a positive way. Social emotional learning is about self-advocacy, self-efficacy, refusal skills, bodily autonomy, how to get along with other people, how to have a conversation with other people, how to debate with other people in a healthy way. That's all social emotional learning. And the more we politicize social emotional learning and turn it into something that it's not and take it away, that's harming kids right there, period, full stop. Every single time I post about it, a friend of mine said, you know, if it's harder to get butts in seats for this topic, then why not provide it in short videos? So I have like 400 short videos on my, at jessicalehi.com, on everything in Gift of Failure and the addiction inoculation and a bunch of student questions I'm answering right now. And some of the biggest pushback I get is around that magical thinking and the myths and the European moderate drinker, but also that social emotional learning thing. Mm-hmm. And that's a hill I'm willing to die on. Social emotional learning is one of the most important things we can do for kids, whether that's at home in our own families, whether that's in school in some more formal way and in the form of a curriculum. That's where we are failing kids, is by turning talking about our feelings into some kind of, whether it's through, you know, boys don't act that way. Girls, we're seeing for the first time in a long time, boys used to outdrink girls, and now girls are outdrinking boys. And I think that comes down to a lot of things, and far be it from me to pin it on one thing, because that would be incorrect to do. That would be folly. But there's a lot of toxic stress that girls are dealing with that we could be addressing, and we have a little ways to go. When I talk about adverse childhood experiences, I would beg people to read the book, The Deepest Well. The Deepest Well is about the expansion of the concept of adverse childhood experiences to include things like adoption, like I said before, divorce and separation, systemic racism, a lot of the stuff that kids are facing that doesn't necessarily fall under the CDC's rubric. Mm-hmm. That's what we needed. We need to be teaching kids that they are allowed to stand up and say what they need, what makes them feel bad, what makes them feel good, and what they need from us as adults. And if we're not doing that, then we're failing them.
Because a lot of this feels like there's a legacy thing here. That you know, when we're not just raising kids, a lot of us are trying to parent differently. Mm-hmm. Parent differently to how we were parented. And yeah. And I, you know, a lot of the people who I work with who have, you know, come across negative consequences as far as alcohol mm-hmm. is concerned, come from, you know, are of a generation where these things weren't talked about. You know, right. We didn't talk about our emotions. We brushed them under the carpet, British stiff upper lip, crack on, boys don't cry, grow up, you know, be a man, all that sort of stuff, all that bullshit. And I suppose even if there are insecurities, even if we have insecurities around talking about alcohol with our children, which, and hopefully your book is going to go a long way to say that we shouldn't have those insecurities, but if we do, we can at least, one of the ways of mitigating risk is to at least talk more about feelings, how are you, and listen, really listen at the same time.
Yeah. So when I go to any school ahead of time, I like to make a little video for the kids, mostly if I'm going to be talking to the kids. And I say, hi, here's who I am. Here's why I'm coming to talk to you. Here's why they're taking time out of your busy class day for me to talk to you. Do you have any questions for me? Here's what I'm an expert in. And I talk to them. Anyway, the emails I get, there are so many questions. Like last time I did this, I got so many questions, like a third of them about caffeine, like how much is too much? No, how, what's, you know, I know that there's a lot. Or sleep. I want to get more sleep. How do I get more sleep? And a lot of it was about stress and how do I manage this? And how do I tell so-and-so that I need them to stop acting that way? And how do I stand up for myself? The questions that I get from kids, they really do want to understand. And when we say, oh, the kids don't want to talk about drugs and alcohol, well, they do, but they're going to need to get their, and they're going to have to get their information from somewhere reliable. The problem is that if we don't have reliable information, then they're not going to view us as a source of reliable information.
Yeah, sure.
We're just guessing, which is why the addiction inoculation has, you know, I try to balance giving you good information with telling stories, because stories are how we engage with information and how we help information become real. So I try not to, you know, I try to have really accurate information without being, you know, rah, 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 and, you know, being one of those peanuts parents. So anyway, we need good information. We need to share it with kids because that's part of their decision-making tree. And that's how we do better for them.
And I think you've struck that balance brilliantly. I really do. For listeners again, Jess's book is The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. It's brilliant. The link is in the notes. It's full of, as you say, it's full of the scripts. It's very much the how-to, not just the why. So lots of truth, lots of the fact and the education. That does credit us with the authority to be able to have these conversations with knowledge. But the scripts, the how-to, I think are probably the most empowering part of the book.
And thank you for mentioning that you listened to the book, because as a huge audiobook consumer, I'm really proud of the audiobook because yeah. Like I said, huge audiobook consumer. I love audiobooks, and it was really important for me to get that one right. And I just loved recording it, so.
Yeah, no, you got it right. It's been with me on many a walk. Some books lend themselves very well to audiobooks. Some of them just feel like nice to haves, but this one really does speak very personally. So thank you. Thank you for doing it. Jess, thank you for coming on. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, of course. This was a pleasure. And I'm just really, really grateful to anyone who opens the floodgates of this conversation. The more we talk about it, the easier it's going to get.
Oh, it's vital. Thank you so much. Thank you. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's the beliefs, B-E-L-I-E-F-S, coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.